Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
Who the fuck is this dude?
You.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is our 100th episode. We begin the show by talking to Meter Mates, a Brooklyn duo made up of the rappers Swell and Sentence, signed to Sage Francis's Strange Famous Records. The group combines hip-hop with the sounds of indie rock to create an exciting new blend. They've even done remixes using the music of folks like Sufjan Stevens and the White Stripes. On the hip-hop side, they've collaborated with a number of impressive names like DJ Rob Swift and the great producer Ninth Wonder, who they even convinced to hop on the mic on a few of their songs together. Their latest album, in large part inspired by Swell's recent fatherhood, is titled We Brought Knives. We caught up with Meter Maids backstage at Brooklyn's Knitting Factory after a set opening for Chesky and Sage Francis. After that, we talked to Gabriel Roth, co-founder of Daptone Records. Roth is a bass player, engineer, producer, music director, and record label owner who has brought soulful music back to the mainstream. He's best known for his work with Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, and for helping the Dap Kings back up Amy Winehouse on her way to world-beating success with her Back to Black album. Along the way, he's been involved with other great acts like Antibalas, Lee Fields, Naomi Shelton and the Gospel Queens, and the Budos Band. He's also a fantastic producer with an ear for things that sound live and soulful without being stuck in a particular decade. If you like The Cypher, please consider helping us to continue by donating to the show at patreon.com/thecyphershow. If you become a patron, we even have exclusive rewards and experiences. Also, please rate, review, and subscribe to the show on iTunes. The more 5-star ratings we get, the better chance we have of continuing to get great guests. You can also find more information, including playlists of all the songs on this episode and our entire back catalog at thecyphershow.com. And now...
Hey, this is Josh, producer of The Cypher. After a lot of harassment, I convinced Sean to add an extra interview guest to this episode, Mr. Sean Sotero himself. I figured, after 100 episodes, it was time to give you a better picture of the nerdiest man in the hip-hop podcast game. So we enlisted Don Will of Tanya Morgan, who has his own podcast, Bad With Names, and was a Cypher guest on episode 94, to give Sean the once-over. But before we get to that, I should give you a little background on Sean. We've known each other since we were about 14, back when Sean looked like what one would imagine a 14-year-old Slash would look like, long hair and all. His room was most notable for the Public Enemy poster, the Jimi Hendrix clock, and the floor covered with variously aged copies of the Village Voice. Sean was the first hip-hop apostle among our friends. While we knew whatever was on the radio, he seemed to have a deeper appreciation for the form, even then. He knew not only what the radio was playing, but what the radio couldn't play. And he could still play Sweet Child of Mine on that sweet Les Paul. After graduating high school and heading off to college in Boston, Sean made his way through the Boston scene, something you've heard about if you've listened. He even introduced two friends who eventually became the pretty famous group, the Dresden Dolls, and played on their first record. Brian Viglione of that group went on to play with Nine Inch Nails and now the Violent Femmes. More importantly, Brian also went on to play drums on the score that Sean wrote for his girlfriend's short horror film, Small Talk. Amanda Palmer went on to be, well, Amanda Palmer. While he was away up north, he still had left such an indelible mark that a group of friends created a band called Sean's Friends from New Jersey. Anyway, Sean has always consistently known more about music than just about anyone I've ever met, mostly because he's more dedicated to learning more about it than anyone. I hope this interview sheds a little light on him and makes you appreciate the show. Thanks for listening. And now, from Crosstown Studios in Harlem, here's Sean Sotero with Don Will, who's somewhere wandering the Southwest.
Sean. Welcome to Bad With Names. I'm your host, Don Will.
crossover. I love it.
Crossover. No, seriously, though. But, like, thank you for giving me the opportunity to actually interview you. I'm in the middle of a tour. Me and Vaughn, Tanya Morgan are out here with Karina, and DJ Halo. I'm literally just showing up in cities and rapping when Vaughn says this is where the stage is. I just walk wherever he tells me to go.
That sounds like just a good plan for life, I think.
Yeah, Vaughn just kind of points me in the general direction of places I need to be. But yeah, man, so my main question for you is, who are you? Seriously, man, like, you have this, like, super, like your knowledge of music and hip-hop and everything is dense. I want a deeper understanding of why you know all the shit you know. You know what I'm saying? Like, you just kind of, like, Wikipedia in these streets. Street Wikipedia.
Streetopedia.
Yeah. Streaming Street Wikipedia.
I mean, you know, that's a good question. I think, you know, I started out, you know, playing guitar when I was pretty young. I guess I started when I was around 10 or 11 and got pretty serious about that pretty quick. I had a guitar teacher who had, you know, when he was young, gone to Berklee College of Music, and he sort of put me on that path, you know, studying stuff out of their books and, you know, sort of learning their curriculum and stuff by the time I was in high school. So, like, you know, I pretended like there were other colleges I was looking at and stuff, but it didn't, there were never really any other options.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I was pretty heavily involved in music in high school and stuff, playing in different bands. And even, you know, in concert band, they even took out an old string bass that was like in mothballs so I could be in the concert band.
Oh, wow.
You know, I think it'd just been sitting there like no one had used it for years.
Until you revived it. You revitalized it.
Exactly. An old K-bass, yeah. Which, you know, I wish I still had that thing, man. That was a beautiful, beautiful instrument.
Do you play? Were you in a band? Do you still play? Or, like, what's your status with that? Are you in the guitar? Is the relationship complicated, so to speak?
It's complicated. We're seeing other people. at a certain point, probably around like 2000 or so, I ended up, I'd always played bass guitar a little bit, but primarily guitar.
And indeed, Sean did play guitar. One of the longest projects he was part of was a group out of Boston called God Boy. Here's a small taste of their sound from their album Soft Jaws, Sweet Teeth, with a track called Alan Alda.
And somewhere around like 2000, I ended up switching to bass full time because there was a band and I ran into their bass player. I was living in Boston, but I was in New York City at the bus station, and I ran into him, to the bass player for this band. And he said, "Oh, I'm moving to New York City." So this was a band that I knew was pretty serious. They were called Helicopter. And I knew they were touring and, you know, even had an indie label, which at that point I didn't know was like just this guy, Paul, you know, but it was a record label. And so I was like, I can do that. I can do with this, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I can totally be in this band. And so it started this long process of, you know, trying to be in this group. From that, from getting in that group and playing with them, I ended up really falling in love with bass, and that has been my primary instrument for a while. Like, there'll still be projects I play guitar with here and there. Most notably,
oh, nice.
My friend Alina Simone. I did a record with her and a lot of touring with her on guitar. Really love that, but most of the projects I've done kind of since then have been on bass.
So I guess the better question, or not better, but the deeper question is, in terms of like journalism, why hip hop? Not necessarily why hip hop, because I know you kind of focus on just, you stray a little bit, but there's definitely a core focus in hip hop in terms of the stuff you cover.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, is it just because it's an innate curiosity, like one of the things you loved, or is it just something, like, why that?
Well, it's funny how that happened, is like, so, you know, I listened to hip hop growing up, you know, at least like when I was very young, whatever stuff made it to the suburbs of New Jersey, you know, the Fat Boys and Run DMC and the Beasties and, you know, whatever, like... Any stuff that kind of made it past the barrier and made it out into the burbs, you know, I was certainly aware of. And then as I got a little older, stuff, you know, when NWA came out, NWA was like some of the first music that I remember being like puzzled by.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, what the fuck is this? Like, I was listening to it and I was like, I know this is a song because it has a chorus. And like, I knew from listening to music, if you have a short part that repeats, it's probably a chorus.
Yo, what the fuck are they yelling?
But like otherwise, it might as well have come from Mars.
Right.
You know, and just being so puzzled by it and so obsessed by it. And Public Enemy, obviously, was huge. But like,
you know, sidebar, I saw that tour, the NWA Public Enemy tour. It was my first concert. I bought a ticket and lied to my mom and went to see the show.
That's amazing. I didn't see either of those folks till much, much later. I didn't get to see NWA in their prime. I saw their NWA reunion in quotes that they did on the Up in Smoke tour, probably like 2000.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. But yeah, so like, I always loved hip hop, but I was listening to tons of stuff, you know, rock and, you know, jazz and, you know, obviously whatever was going on at the time musically. But like, as I got into college, you know, a music school is a very different animal than like what I imagine most colleges are. And Berkeley especially is very much a jazz school.
Yeah.
So all day I was in a position of like looking at music from the point of view of like, what are they doing? You know, can I do this? How is it working? And so it, ironically, given where I would end up later on, hip hop was sort of the one form of music where I didn't have to worry about that, where it wasn't something that I was making or might be working on or in theory might be making. So it was like, okay, I can just listen to this.
Right.
You know, I didn't have to approach it from like, how does it break down for me? How do I compare to this?
Yeah, like you could just sit back and like enjoy it and love the sport of it. And like, you know what I'm saying? Admire the artist without having to look at them like... Like when I go to a rap show, I'm watching people like breaking down their stage show and analyzing, like seeing what I would do or what I wouldn't do or whatever, versus you would go to the show and just enjoy it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so it started out, you know, that in college was when hip hop went from being some of my listening, you know, over a couple of years to being basically all of it. That was, you know, 1990, you know, back when, yeah. back when I was in college.
Yeah, I was in college in 90 as well. We were around the same time. The good old U's.
Yeah, they were right. It was a great time. It was a great time, I remember it fondly. And so there was always something about hip hop, and this is why initially Rap Genius was such a good fit. I always sort of saw the connections between lyrics, between artists. I think this is, you know, one of the reasons I gravitated to Jay-Z so early on is like, you know, an artist would say something and they would be referring to another song and it would almost be in some ways like a hyperlink in my head, you know, well before was on the web. Like, oh, you know, he's talking about this. This is from a record, you know, several years ago. And so I really, almost without realizing it, started building up this, you know, enjoying kind of getting into that game of like hearing a record and being like, oh, that's what Snoop was talking about, or, you know, like, oh, there's an original version of this, you know, blah-de-da-de or whatever, you know, something I had missed growing up, like, you know, getting into that whole kind of backstory ended up becoming its own sort of fascination for me.
Your history with Rap Genius, what's the background with that? I mean, I know that's where I met you at, for the most part, was in the Rap Genius offices.
Yeah, it was through the office. So the funny thing about all that is actually years before, you know, Rap Genius existed, my girlfriend, who I'm still with, you know, she liked Jay-Z, but she didn't listen to him a ton. And I was like, oh no, you don't understand. So I ended up creating basically an annotated version of the lyrics for her. Like, oh, I had a shitty day job. I had nothing else to do. You know, I was pretending to be, I don't know, filing something or, you know, doing something that, you know, probably, you know, in theory was important.
You were working for the man. You were making him rich.
Yeah. I was on, at that point, I was doing temp jobs. I was on what my friend likes to call the free cell circuit.
Yeah, because that's all you would really do at work is play free cell.
Exactly.
I know about that shit.
So instead of playing free cell or lurking on OK Player.
Holler.
You know, yeah, exactly. I typed out the lyrics to this record and started making little footnotes of like, oh, this is a, you know, when he says sycamore tree, that's a reference to this Biggie lyric and so forth.
I was conceived by Gloria Carter and Agnes Reeves, who made love under the sycamore tree, which makes me a more sicker MC and my mama.
With my sycamore style, more sicker than yours, 4-4 and 54 draws.
Specifically, you know, for her, you know, just to be like, hey, this is this thing I'm really into, and like, this is sort of the full context for it.
That is love. That is love. That's love.
And you know, she's a Big J fan, which, you know, now, which I take, you know, a tiny bit of credit for.
You should. Okay. So you did that for her.
So I did that. And so just to give you an idea of like, I was already sort of thinking in that way of like the connections in lyrics and between different, you know, rap records in the outside world and rap records and other rap records. And then I came across what was, I didn't realize at the time, but the very first piece of press Rap Genius ever got, which was like a little thing on the approval matrix of New York Magazine. The site, which was then called Rap Exegesis, made it onto the board. I'm still not sure how that happened or who they knew. But I saw that and checked it out. And it was like, holy shit, someone took my brain and put it on the internet. Like, what is this? And it was small enough at that point that I, you know, hopped on and left a comment of like, this is great, but you got some stuff wrong, I'm sure, was something, you
right.
know, something like what I said, you know. And it was small enough that I actually got a call from one of the founders, you know, on the phone and got hooked up with an account. It was very, very small at that point. I think I might have been the first person outside of their circle of college friends to become involved.
Oh, dope. I got to wrap it up soon because I have to go rap.
Of course.
But Ching. But I want to ask one last question. This is one that's a deep burning question. I've been wondering for a while.
Uh-oh.
Did you actually make Serato and just change your last name to throw everybody off? Like, did you develop the software?
I wish. I had long thought that if I ever wanted to DJ, you know, the name would write itself.
But you should play only vinyl at that if you DJ. Because it'll be like that extra amount of like, you know what I'm saying? I'm Sean Serato, but I only play vinyl. Boom. But yeah, I gotta hop off. But yeah, I just wanted to let you know before I hop off, I really love the show. Like I'm a latecomer to the show, but the style of interview, you know what I'm saying? The style of journalism, like the way that you put the stories together is really dope. It's one of my favorites. And I listen to a lot of podcasts, but yours is one that I listen to intently and I check it out. I check for it regularly now.
Thank you so much, Don, and likewise on Bad With Names. Thanks, man. That was our talk with me. And now, backstage from the Knitting Factory in Brooklyn, here's our talk with Meaner Maids. So like I was saying, it's like you guys closed with I Am, and it's appropriate being that we're here in a very noisy Williamsburg club.
And that song was inspired by this neighborhood.
Yeah, I had a weird night with a friend where we just split a handle of whiskey for no reason, just like a Friday night where we were just supposed to catch up. And I got, you know, I felt a certain way on the train ride home, just thinking about, you know, you look at people and you're like, oh man, you think you're cool because of this. And then you're like, well, but maybe I think that I'm cool because I see that you're cool. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You just realize we're all doing the same shit. So I don't know. I thought it was a fun idea to put a song together of all of the pieces of music that make me who I am, I guess.
You got the money, honey. We got your disease. Number 9 should have been number 1 to me. You can't hurt me. I'm banned in D.C. because the piano's been drinking, not me.
Yeah, as is usually the case with Meter Made songs, I don't really know what they're about. And Sean tells me, like, his idea. He's like, yeah, okay, I'll write about that.
And then he just raps better than me. That's what happens.
And, you know, I have to ask about that tune in particular. You know, it ends with Bruce.
The boombox is dead. It's seen its best days. The screen door slams. Mary's dress waves. The screen door slams. Mary's dress waves.
And I'm from Jersey as well, so, you know, got to my heart.
It's everything.
Yeah. Yeah, what is it, I mean, for you, you know, since people think, oh, he's a rapper, like, but you started out playing in rock bands.
Yeah. Well, yeah, when I was, like, 14, that's how I got into it, for sure. It sucked. It was terrible.
Well, like, everyone's rock band when they're 14. It's fucking terrible. But what was, like... And then when you started rapping, like, what were kind of the differences between that, both, like, in terms of songwriting and in terms of performance?
It was, I don't know. It's like, it's actually something I've thought about a lot, you know, like, with a song, you know, with any sort of melodic song, melody is going to inform so much of how something feels, right? And then you're able to say so much more with so much less. With hip-hop, it's like, I feel like it's a much more difficult process because there's a lot more to consider, right? Like, on a technical level. And
yeah, but I think that, like, what we do, you can kind of feel that influence a little bit because Sean's a lot more musical because, like you said, he, like, kind of came up doing rock music and whatever, and I just started doing hip-hop, and that's all I ever did was rap.
So, like, drums, though?
Well, I mean, I played drums, but, you know. So, like, I think Sean kind of really brings that element of just more musicality and more like planning to a song than a lot of hip hop artists really consider, you know? So, I think it gives it an interesting dynamic.
Yeah. You guys were talking about, you know, playing instruments and stuff. Your first couple records are really sort of live instrument heavy. There's a lot of guitars and stuff like that.
Had a tap, but it never got filled, and ink spilling through the cracks in the back of the building. He was laughing with the blood.
Yeah, so I then, our, you know, like, our brother Matt Stein, who does the production, is like incredibly talented musically, and we have some friends too who are like virtuosos, you know. And so I think that was like the, like, you know, the exciting thing for us starting out was trying to find some hybrid of the music, the different kinds of music that we like.
Yeah, it's always like Smash Smash Bang, I think. Yeah. There's a lot of like live
it's
stuff.
All,
kind of
yeah, it's
map,
all
yeah.
Drums and guitar. Yeah, we just have been surrounded with these like super talented people that it felt silly to not use them somehow, you know?
Yeah. And since you were from Denver originally, right?
Yep, I'm from Denver.
What was the, like, that's not a city, hip-hop-wise, I know a ton about. Should I? No? Yes?
No, you shouldn't. No. I'm sorry.
That's why you're here and not Denver.
I mean, I'm not trying to badmouth Denver. There's definitely people there who are talented, and there's, it, you know, it's got its own scene, but...
Did it ever have, like, that, the dude, like, the Denver dude? Did Denver ever have that?
Did Denver ever have a dude?
Yeah.
Not that anyone ever really knew about.
Right.
I mean, there was, like, Black Pegasus who, like, got pretty high in Scribble Jam, and there was like EDM producers now, you know,
right,
but
yeah.
not any like big hip hop names. So like, yeah, I mean, it had its scene, but like, it was, everyone was just kind of like scrounging for scraps. So it wasn't a very welcoming scene. So we really had to carve stuff out, and it wasn't like we were like networking with a lot of people who were really down to like collaborate. It was beefy, and it was like, all right, well, we're gonna do our shit, and we're gonna do it better than you are, and we did that to a certain extent with some people, but it didn't matter, you know, because we had our fans and they had theirs, and it wasn't very it wasn't a warm time in my life.
Which is funny, because Denver's like mad receptive to hit. Like, Denver's a great place to play.
Now when you're there,
yeah.
And the thing about you guys, especially seeing you tonight, like, you get the feeling like you're very, you know, comfortable and dynamic in this kind of like underground space. But there was a period like 08, 09, when you guys were first starting out, when you tried to do success kind of a more traditional way, showcases and, you know.
It was an experience. It's like, it's hard to look back on that and not think it was wasted time a little bit.
I don't know.
I mean, we,
yes, it was.
It was.
But we also like did some stuff that most people don't ever get to experience.
Yeah, like we got to have like some meetings with some heavy hitters, and like people said some ill shit to us, you know what I mean? Like, it got us all gassed.
Kind of like, are you ready to be a star kid?
No, literally.
I think those exact words came out of somebody's mouth.
We sat down, like, we don't need to name names, but yeah. one of the biggest publicists in the game came into a room, and she sat down and she was like, are you ready to be famous? You know, and like when you're fucking 23, 24, you're like, yeah, of course.
And it was like, all right, so we're gonna do these shows. You have to pretend not to have girlfriends.
Pretend not to have
girlfriends.
You gotta
act like you're younger than you really are.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Tell them you're younger. They're like, we're gonna surround you with girls. So we're like talking to our girls. I think I was even fucking engaged at the time. We're telling our women, like, listen, like,
just for
show. We're gonna be photographed with women.
You can't be around us.
You can't be around us.
Cool.
But and you know, like it's like a testament to how down our ladies were that they were like, fuck it, yeah. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, fucking do what you need to do. Which makes it even worse. It makes it even worse that they were down and we still whiffed on it.
Yeah, we whiffed.
Did you? And you were making different kind of music during that period.
Yeah, you know, we don't need to get into that too much.
Yeah.
Like, no,
I mean,
you know,
no one's heard it, right?
We did this, like, back then. The music we were making had no business being anywhere near radio, you know, or anything that anyone would care about.
Yeah.
And even later, when we got close, it still just wasn't ever gonna be like that. Not that we didn't fucking try and weren't devastated when we failed. You want your bag, Sage?
Are my pants back there?
Way to make it weird. Thanks.
I don't see any.
I see some pants.
Oh, there you go.
All right.
And so just to get to the live performance, since that literally just ended, you know, minutes ago, it was awesome. Like, you guys are really, really energetic, and I think more than like the energy you put out and the back and forth is just like, you guys look really comfortable with each other.
I mean, yeah.
You can't see it, but we're actually just holding each other right now.
I'm a little uncomfortable right now.
It's funny because it started off like, you know, just sort of a natural thing when we had a couple songs together and we performed and it was just fun. And now at this point, it's like, you know, we've slept in the same bed together so many times. It's, you know, like, well, he's like my best friend. Like, it's not something that you have to fake, you know what I mean? Or even really practice, you know? Like, it's...
Yeah, I mean, we've seen each other
naked, like...
We've done this, like, so many times, you know? And, like at this point, we just kind of, like, finish each other's...
Sandwiches.
Yeah,
that's like a shitty movie line.
I'm sorry.
You pulled
it off, though.
I'm sorry.
Good timing.
And but there was a Meter Maids that was just you shot at first.
Yeah,
and
that's
then...
what it started off.
Yeah.
As, yeah. So like literally like the and this is you know like our funny story is the you know everyone remembers MySpace, like that was the shit when we first started, and the first message that I ever got in my MySpace inbox was sentence from Denver being like, hey, I'm moving to New York and looking at people to build with. And I didn't respond because like I was like, who the fuck is this dude? But then, you know, like just from like you know, like the first time I saw him perform, it's like, this, he's the best in our scene, you know what I mean? And it was like, fuck, man, we should be doing stuff together.
And he was already Meter Maids. He was just Meter Maids.
Well established, making money. Well,
I had to break through some walls. Yeah.
He had to sign contracts to get down with the behemoth.
So then, yeah, so I came to New York and I was doing solo stuff and he was doing solo stuff. And then we went on tour together and like a couple shows in, we were just like, man, we should just
do this together. Right? Yeah.
And so then we're like, well, should we just keep the Meter Maids or should we call ourselves the Crocodilians?
That was the name. It was very close to being Crocodilians. So.
What could have been?
Maybe we would have been fucking successful. God damn it.
Yeah. So you guys have We Brought Knives, new record, yes. Came out a few months back. And one of the singles off it is Profiteer that I wanted to talk about for a second. You did a video for it. Mm-hmm. And there's that phrase on it that it comes up again. It's, you know, it's about people who've passed and sort of about like musicians who've passed and their legacies and the ways people deal with that. And there's this phrase, I'm never gonna let you die.
Got your name tatted on my flesh. Yeah, we bout it, bout it. Story written in my heart. Yeah, we love it, love it. I'm never gonna let you die. I'm never gonna let you die.
If I'm reading it right, the sort of speaker in the song thinks is touching, but has kind of a creepy edge to it.
I appreciate it. No, totally, that's what we're going for. I think like, you know, there's real world examples that we could point to. Maybe if I had like a drink in me, I would, you know.
it feels
super exploitative sometimes, you know, like especially people who are like on the fringes of someone's life who all of a sudden feel like they can take ownership over their memory, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, so totally. That's like, you nailed it.
The other tune that, you know, one of them that really jumped out at me, and again, when you did a video for Advice I Know You Won't Follow, which Sean, you did as an acapella today at the show, that was super affecting.
Thank you, man.
Yeah. I'm interested in that song because I think it's full of stuff that, as far as I can tell, you guys actually believe.
Tell the people that you love them. Make music like nobody, you'll hear it. If you're ever at a wedding and the dance floor is empty,
dance hard, motherfucker.
Be fearless. Don't play video games in public. Never take shots at people in private. Don't hate your favorite band for selling out arenas, even though the club shows are the livest. Bruce Springsteen is the truth. I used to sing Thunder Road when I rocked you to sleep. Remember people's names when you meet. Nas the best MC. He just picks shitty beats.
And you actually want to do pass on as, you know, advice, sentence you were going to say?
No, I mean, that was kind of the point of it. It was like, you could write some, like, cheesy song about, like, oh, here's the beautiful things you should do with your life. Or, like, we just decided that, like, let's just, like, do, like, a real life advice song.
Yeah, and it's also, like, as a dad, you're like, if I got hit by a bus, my wife would be able to tell him, like, don't be a dick, you know, like, fucking be nice to people. That's all covered. It's like the important shit, like knowing that Bruce Springsteen is the shit. And
sample only from vinyl.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, if I get hit by, like, that needs to be on record somewhere if I get hit by a bus.
But then there's the title of the song, which kind of gives this whole twist to it.
Yeah, well, you know, like that, like, you like, when you think about, I remember my parents sitting me down and talking to me about how to deal with drugs, you know, it doesn't matter, right? Like, you have to bump your head into it.
Yeah.
You know, like, there's nothing you could do.
Yeah.
Maybe my son will think that Nas picks great beats.
Maybe.
He'll be wrong. Yeah. He'll disappoint his dad. But,
And the record before that was Rooftop Shake, which was like probably the most, you know, for lack of a better term, kind of like hip hop record musically that you'd done up to that point.
I make the rooftop shake. I make the rooftop shake. We be the bad news bears.
Hold up.
We in the building like broken phone jacks and cold tap. Night dressed up, head to toe in full black. Speakers hit with closed hands and with the sleeves rolled back. So your group's kind of big with the black.
What moved you in that direction?
I think for the most part it's because we were collaborating with Ninth Wonder.
Sure.
And his musical style is just so classic hip hop, and I think that we wanted to do that justice.
He's just so fucking awesome, dude.
Yeah, how did that come about?
So our manager at the time was managing one of his artists, and we found out, and we're like, oh my God, like, biggest fan of the dude. And then he turned out to be like just the awesomest guy, like so funny, so like talented in a way that is almost embarrassing for people who make beats. Like, the dude can sit down and knock something outrageous out. So it's like, he's just so nice. It was just such a good experience. You know?
Yeah.
That's like one of the happiest times of my entire life was being down in North Carolina and doing that, man. We smoked too many fucking cigarettes, but.
Yeah, we went down there for a couple of sessions and just hung out at Ninth Studio. And he was like producing like literally three beats every half an hour.
It was
insane.
Yeah, I've heard the story about him like making Threat sort of on the spot or whatever.
Yeah, Jay-Z literally was like, sample that and left the room and was like, you know, like, I'm going to come back. But that's the other thing too about it is that you get in a booth with a dude who's watched Jay-Z record and you're like, fuck me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we redid everything that we'd recorded. We recorded in North Carolina.
So nervous.
Yeah, it wasn't very good. So we redid everything when we got back.
Yeah. And so how on earth did you get him on the mic? That's because he raps on a couple of those songs.
He wanted to do it.
Hey, to save a steal, follow my coattail. Fly on my stairway to heaven with no rail. Gone out your league and every MC nowhere. Hear the name, know my beat game, so share.
And like, the thing is, he kills it. And he's got an amazing voice. I don't know, like, we just, like, I don't know. I think, like, because he could see in us that, like, we're not, like, we really don't have too much of an ego about it. You know what I mean? It's just, like... And what I really appreciate, I mean, I'm sure what Sentence did too, like, he was like, it was like being with your friends who just love hip hop, like the people that you started with, you freestyle with, like, that's who he is. Like, he lives and breathes it. He just happens to be, like, incredibly talented.
Yeah.
And, you know, back on the new record, you have The Contender, and, you know, Sean, you wrote an essay about it, you know, and where you talked about, like, this idea of you guys working, you know, sort of day jobs in order to have time to devote to the group while, you know, you're getting a little older and your friends are going to grad school and they're becoming professionals.
I'm a big fish. I just got little fins. And then there's a heart. Middle ain't great either. Ready for the big time. Senioritis. Eighth grade fever. Didn't ever really know the best approach to take, but knew I'd break my back by hoping I could make you a believer. Bright as rain. Good as gold. You can count on me. More than just another stubborn, hungry mouth to feed. Wasn't made up neat, like, not laid out for me. I did my best. I tried to be proud of me. On my back. I can carry the bricks. I can carry the sticks. I can carry the stones. Put it on my back. I can carry the skin.
And I feel like that's something that artistic folks deal with.
Yeah.
But in the sort of face they present to the world, just pretend doesn't happen, really. What inspired you to be so open about that in the song and then in the essay?
I don't know. Like, I feel like in my life, it's just been super real. Like, I grew up with some really fucking smart people, like, in my family included. My little brother's brilliant. He's a lawyer. My sister is killing it. Like, basically all of my friends are doctors and lawyers now. And, like, you know, so for us, like, you go to family gatherings and, you know, it's like, what are you up to? And it's like, well, we're trying to be a rap group.
This is another instance, though, where it's like, because, like, Sean might come up with, like, a concept or something, and I have to interpret it my own way because I know zero lawyers, zero people. I'm like, my friends, like, work at restaurants and, like, are garbage men, literally. So it's like, I just kind of interpret it in my own way, but, like,
yeah, no, that's true. I don't know smart people.
Nice. And you guys obviously have a pretty strong relationship with indie rock. You've stylistically, like, some of the music you did, and then also you guys did a remix album of Sufjan Stevens, you know, using his stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But what I wanted to talk about with that was the stuff you did with Rob Swift. Where he did some remixes for you guys, although they're not really remixes exactly.
This morning cigarette tasted like last night, and last night like the one before. I made my bed in the morning when I woke up. I picked my clothes up off the floor. I rode the train like a ghost in the graveyard. I walked the streets like a criminal son. I pulled my hat real low. I had apologies for everyone.
Well, Rob Swift mixed the CD, but the remixes were actually made by the producer we typically work with, Mass Dime.
Okay.
He just put it all together.
He's also like the awesomest guy ever, yeah, who just happens to be phenomenally talented.
Yeah.
Yeah, bro, shouts to Rob Swift, dude. Love that guy.
Yeah, so how'd you get hooked up with him?
That was a friend of mine who's kind of connected in the music industry, but it's through like marketing and art and whatever. And so he'd worked with Rob Swift on some mixtapes that a company he was working with was putting out. And then, I don't know, it just kind of fell into place.
That's awesome. And then like, so some of the videos that you guys have online for that are kind of like movie mashups and stuff.
Yeah.
That's the funny shit. So
who did those first off?
I went through a phase where I thought that was the funniest shit in the world, was like just jacking clips and putting them together. I like learning iMovie, you know, and you're like, this is so fucking easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some of them were better than others.
Yeah. Some, like much, much
better. I saw the Jean-Claude Van Damme one today.
See,
that was amazing.
That's like that was me. When there's craftsmanship involved, its sentence. When there's like a decent idea executed poorly, those are mine.
and finally, like, you know, obviously you guys have had two records on Strange Famous. It was Strange Famous, Bill Tonight. What does the label like mean to you guys? Like, what do you see about it that you relate to, that you connect with?
Like, it's Black Hat, Black Jacket, right?
Maybe my bones will go to sleep up in the jet plane. If not, I'll be at work the next day. Like, Black Hat, Black Jacket.
It's like blue collar hip hop again. Like, it's people that we love as people, right? Like, you know, would fucking take a bat to someone for. And I just think, like, if you look at the catalog of music that they've put out, like, there's nothing flashy about it. It's just like fucking good on a technical level, like. You know, obviously, like, Sage Francis is, like, one-of-a-kind talent. I think B. Dolan's, like, one of the more slept-on people, like, in the history of the genre. Like, when you look at what that dude's capable of, it's unbelievable. And then, like, prolific. You know, like, Buddy Peace, like, our friend out in London, like, the kid is unreal. It never tried to do anything, like, trendy or flashy. It's just, like, fucking good music. You know what I mean?
It's just, like, authentic. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, like, there's nothing flashy. It was, like, they defined their own, like, part of the genre through just doing what they love to do. And
have kept it that way.
Yeah, have kept it the whole time.
The whole time.
And they haven't compromised.
Yeah. And that's sort of the polar opposite of the stuff we were talking about earlier, like 08, 09, when you're trying for a more sort of conventional...
I think that... coming into the fold with those people helps you as a person remember why you did it in the first place and why you want to continue doing it. You're like, you know, Sage has never fucking bowed to anything, you know? Like, ever.
Yes.
So fuck, man. Like, I don't have that level of talent in me, but I can follow that ethos or whatever you got, you know? Yeah.
And, you know, one of the themes on this record, and, you know, that you've talked about is you guys have families.
Yeah.
No?
I don't.
Just you.
Sense has families he doesn't know about.
Yeah. But, so Sean, having children and doing, like, does that affect the kind of stuff you can do to promote the record in terms of shows and things like that?
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's a discussion that we've been having. It's fucking tough, you know? Like, it's tough. We had one cram session rehearsal last night. You know, like, my wife had to leave the show early because the kid isn't sleeping. Like, you know, I'm leaving her for a couple of days now for her to hold down the household. Like, I'm not really feeling it. Like, it's tough. So, yeah, like, we would, you know, in a perfect world, we would go out and hit the road for a month. but I'm not, I never loved touring anyway, really, because I'm like a routine person. But yeah, no, it's fucking hard. So we have to sort of pick our spots.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, speaking of like doing stuff in concentrated bursts, like you actually did the record. And I was reading this, I couldn't believe it. You wrote it in a day and then recorded it in
it's
a
like
day.
A little,
how far apart those
good,
days were.
I mean, you took some liberties with your timelines there.
We wrote a lot in a night. Like
we kind of conceptualized the album and wrote first drafts for at least half of it.
More than half. Two thirds of it in a night.
We went up to Jersey to Sean's parents' house, like locked ourselves in, got whiskey and sun chips, and just put beats on.
Champion fucking.
Yeah.
And we just got back and forth, like sitting at this computer, and like we were both trying to write at the same time. And that was kind of the meat of it, and that was where the record came from, was from those.
And we tracked most of it in a day and overnight too.
Yeah, that's true.
Like we definitely had to go back and edit, but no, but again, like we couldn't, like we can't fuck around anymore. You know what I mean? Like we can't go and have a session where we're trying to make beats and leave without a beat, you know? Like it doesn't fly anymore. Like we have to be fucking productive, which is, you know, like, which is weird because it's the most crafted shit we've ever done. Like, even when we didn't necessarily have families, it's always been tough. New York's tough, right? We both work full time. Like, it's fucking, you know, we're not like working 6 hours at Starbucks and then having like, you know, 3 days off. Like, his schedule's been brutal for most of his time, yeah.
And, but this record, like you said, I think you really took your time with it. I know you guys think of it as, you use the words defining statement. Like, what does that mean?
You know what I'm talking about?
Your words. I don't know.
Sure. No, I mean, I think that we have always gone in and tried to make cool shit that we like, with a few exceptions, where we made shit that wasn't cool that we hoped other people would like. But with this one, like, I think we consciously were like, felt like we had developed our style and that we could explore it and just wanted to like do something that we hoped would impress people, as because I think we've always been like, I think our output, people have always been like, yeah, that's pretty cool, and like they're good live, but you know, I don't think that people were ever necessarily impressed with us, so we wanted to fucking try to impress people.
Yeah.
Does that sound right?
Yeah. I mean, I think the other thing for me at least was like the first album we did together, Nightlife, which isn't the greatest album. I mean, it's okay.
It's pretty good, I guess.
Pretty good. But I think it was honest. It was like really honest. You know, we didn't like hold anything back. And then we did a series of albums after that that were good. And I think that they were...
We were just sort of talking shit. Right?
Yeah, I mean, they were creative. And I think that they were pretty dope albums. But it was kind of surface level. I mean, take Rooftop Shake, for example, like the hip hop album. It's like, yeah, okay. Like,
yeah.
But then, so I think one of the things that we accomplished on this one was just like honesty. We didn't like hold anything back. We actually like touched on some stuff that was just real to us and meant something to us, and I don't know, for me, like that's more defining than
for sure anything else. Yeah, that's a good point.
Okay, well, that's a great note to end on. Thank you guys so much for your time. I'm glad we finally
nice
got to meet
I know.
Up.
It was so nice to meet you guys, man.
That was Metermates, and now via sometimes dodgy Skype connection from California, here's Gabriel Roth of Daptone Records.
So I wanted to start out by kind of going way back to the beginning of you kind of putting out records, because there's a super funny thing that happened with stuff like the Daktaris and the Revenge of Mr. Mapoji and things like that, where you would kind of make up bands and movies, you know, soundtracks to movies that didn't exist and so forth. What was the thinking behind that originally?
You know, the first one was just kind of a goof. You know, my partner at the time with Desco Records, Philip, was kind of just a crazy dude and, you know, a record collector. And he was just trying to get over on people. He kind of got off on kind of getting over on people. So we did Revenge of Mr. Mapoji, you know, and tried to make it as close to, you know, kind of Slaughter's Big Ripoff or something like that is what we were going for, you know.
Mm-hmm.
we may have missed it, but that's what we were going for. And we sold a bunch of them, told them, you know, everybody thought they were legitimate issues. And then after that, you know, we'd sold a bunch of records. So we thought, oh man, this is amazing. So we did another record called Give Me the Paw, which also came out as Soul Tequila. And that was the first record we did with Lee Fields and Sharon Jones, people like that. This is about 1997 or something. And it was by the same band, the Soul Providers, you know, the same band that's on Revenge of Mr. Rapoji. And we put it out. We kind of told everybody, hey, guess what? That record was us. You know, it wasn't, you know, the joke's on you. It's, you know, it's a new thing. And the new record, Give Me the Paw, was a much better record. I mean, obviously, I mean, it had Lee Fields on it. You know, it was an amazing record. Had all kinds of great tracks on it and stuff. And somehow nobody bought it. Nobody cared about it. You know, we couldn't give it away. And that was our experience a couple times. I mean, like the first 45 we did was this Lee Fields 45, Steam Train and Let a Man Do What He Wanted To, which, you know, still I'm proud of, one of the best records I ever made, I think. A great record. And we were going into record stores, Philip and I, all over New York and Philly and stuff. We'd drive around record stores and we were trying to sell them for like $2, $3, you know, I think $2 at the time we were trying to sell them for. And nobody would buy them. And, you know, we only had a couple hundred. So we're like, fuck, what are we going to do with these things? So we took them down in the basement and rubbed them with newspaper and made them look old. You know, we tried to find a balance between worn and not, you know, we didn't want to scratch them up, you know.
Right.
But we wore them a little bit, you know, we made them look like they'd been played a few times. And then we would just go into a record store with one copy and say, hey, I got this record, you want to buy it? And we'd sell them for $30, $40, $50, you know what I mean?
Just amazing.
One at a time and scratched up records. So it was weird because it kind of started off like us trying to pull something over on people. And at the end of it, we kind of learned this twisted lesson about, you know, at least the funk scene and the soul scene stuff at that time, which was like, nobody wanted to hear a new band. And I understand it because I was the same way then. I mean, you know, the Brand New Heavies was kind of cool, but it wasn't what anybody, you know, people that were into funk records were into these raw, dirty kind of funk records. And you had these kind of acid jazz scene. So none of the new bands sounded like that. And, you know, anybody who was really into old funk records was not buying new records, you know, myself included. And, you know, we weren't the first to do it. You know, I got tricked by the Poets of Rhythm. And, you know, the first time I heard them, I thought it was an old band. I got into them thinking it was old music. I heard Augusta, Georgia or something on some funk compilation. Sure, it was an old record. I thought it was bananas, you know.
Yeah. And so did you ever have people come up to you and say, oh man, I saw that Mapoji movie, or like, oh, I have that other record by the Daktaris or whatever?
Oh yeah, man. You know, the thing is, in record stores, the guys who own record stores and people in music and business in general are no, you know, they're no strangers to bullshitting, man. Like it's some of the biggest bullshitters in the world work at record stores. You know, they're always trying to be more obscure than everybody and know more than everybody. So yeah, we'd go in there and we'd play dumb. We'd say, man, we don't know anything about it. We just, you know, we're just reissuing it. We got the one copy. And people, you know, Robert from Final Vinyl, who's passed since, rest in peace, but he used to tell us, oh yeah, I've got the original and my friend has the movie on VHS. And we kept saying, oh, I'd love to see it. I'd love to see it. And he kept saying, I'm going to bring it. When are you coming by? I'm going to tell him to bring it down, you know. And meanwhile, he's bullshitting us. He doesn't realize the whole time we know there is no movie, you know. And he keeps telling us he's going to show up with the VHS. And I had, you know, the Daktaris, everybody bit into that one. And it was funny because we put that out and the distributors and everybody was telling us, oh, you need a band photo. You need a biography. You need all this stuff. This is how you do it in the record business. You need all this stuff. And we just kept saying, no, we don't have any of it. We don't have any of that. They kept saying, you can't sell records without that. You need all these things. But the less information we gave, the more people made it up, you know? And people bought the shit out of that record. We sold like 5,000-6,000 copies, which at the time for us was like a gold record, you know? It was a lot of records.
Yeah. And a lot of people would say, and you know, you don't shy away from this to your credit, that that actually kind of started the Afrobeat revival.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was probably Fela dying was a bigger, you know, thing. But yeah, I mean, we recorded that before Fela died, and we recorded it. You know, it's a real fucked up sounding recording. It's real distorted and stuff. And we kept playing it for people. And everybody said, man, that record sounds like garbage. Don't put that out. So we actually shelved it. We actually didn't put it out. And then when Fela passed, all of a sudden there was a very small moment where people were like, who is Fela?
Fela Kuti was a Nigerian musician who was the pioneer of the genre known as Afrobeat. Afrobeat combines Nigerian and Ghanaian music styles with jazz and James Brown-style funk to create an incredibly danceable form of music. It is exemplified in the track Lady, originally featured on his 1972 album Shakara. Extremely popular in Africa, Fela never really gained the renown he deserved in the United States until after his death in 1997, as Gabe explains here. His passing, along with the release of records like the Doctares, led to a revival of the Afrobeat sound. In 2008, the revival led to an off-Broadway production called Fela, which began as a collaboration between Daptone's own Antibalas and Tony Award-winning director Bill T. Jones. Jones and Antibalas then took the show to Broadway itself, and the show, whose producers included Jay-Z and Will Smith, was nominated for 11 Tony Awards.
You know, and there was it wasn't quite a revival at the time, but there was a peaked interest, and we thought, well, if ever we're going to put it out, let's put it out now. So we put it out, we dedicated it to Fela, and, you know, it was kind of I think there was a certain moment there.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, Martin Perna, who at the time was my roommate, was really into the Doctares, and you know, he played on that record a little bit. He played a couple solos and stuff. I think he didn't play a lot on it, but he was on a couple tracks, and he was so into it and got so into Fela with me. You know, we had a couple Fela records we used to just blast in the apartment down on the Lower East Side all the time, and he just wanted to play that music live so bad, and we couldn't quite get the Doctares off the ground, so he started Antibalas, you know.
Yeah.
And him and Mike Wagner and me and a bunch of the same guys ended up playing in Antibalas. I think Philip at the beginning was even playing with Antibalas. But it kind of came out of there.
Amazing.
But there was a lot of bullshit around that record. I mean, I had ethnomusicologists from, you know, UCLA calling me on the phone at Desco and lecturing me about, you know, the dumber I played, the more I said, oh, I don't know anything about it, the more they would make up, you know. They realized there was no information out there, so they just started making it up, man. It was definitely an interesting, you know, experiment in the way that kind of thing goes, in conventional wisdom, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
But they would tell me, you know, this guy told me, oh, I have the first record. This is the second record by the Doctares. I have the first one. It's a lot more traditional.
Oh, really? You do? That's interesting. Yeah.
All kinds of baloney. Yeah.
So one of the things, you kind of hinted at something there, which is when Antibalas started out, you know, it was... And pretty much all the bands that ended up on Desco and Daptone, it was kind of a loose collective. Like the group names, you know, didn't really mean so much. But then as the group started touring, you actually had to decide who was in which act.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't as much an official thing like we needed it for some public roster or something. It was just more about the practicality of who's going to play the show. Because basically the sole providers were starting to do well and starting to do some tours. And Antibalas was starting to do some shows. And it got to the point where okay, there's two shows on this weekend. Who's going to play them? You know, and that's kind of been a long time Daftone problem. We still go through that, you know, because there's obviously core members of all these bands, but there's a lot of, you know, most of the guys who've been in the family for a while have played gigs with almost every band, you know? I mean, almost, you know, almost everybody in these bands, whether in the horn section, the rhythm section, whatever, has played with Lee Fields at one point in time, Charles Bradley, Naomi, Antti Balas, you know, subbed in the Buros band, subbed in, you know, whatever. I mean, I played guitar on, you know, Luke O'Malley from Antti Balas has played Daft Kings gigs. I mean, these are the best guys. These are the guys that know the music, even if they haven't played in your particular band. So, yeah, I mean, it's always kind of been that, it's always been kind of that family element to it. You know, we had a weekend, it was like all the bands had a gig at the same time and nobody could figure out who was playing what. You know, I ended up playing guitar on the Daft Kings gig and somebody else played bass so that Joey could go play guitar on the Charles. I mean, it's really complicated, you know, I mean, it's like...
One specific thing about the sound of the stuff you guys do that I thought was super interesting is in so many of the songs, you obviously have qualities of different kinds of music from the 60s and 70s. But, you know, almost never, I mean, I think in listening to a ton of your catalog to prepare for this, I heard maybe one or two things. Almost never do you have like specific musical ideas that you can say, hey, that's from that James Brown song or that Otis Redding song or anything. Like you, yeah. How do you walk that line between capturing the sound and feel of an era and not copying specific ideas?
Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, I think a lot of it doesn't really come from, it kind of comes from looking at it the other direction. You know, I mean, the way we're doing it is we're not trying to make old records and then make them sound new or trying to make something new that sounds old. We're just trying to make records that sound really good. And the reason why they sound like records from the 60s and shit is because that's what we're into and that's what sounds good to us. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like if it's not like a, you know, there's no agenda behind it. There's no fetishist thing. And I think that's what at times separates us from some of the other kind of retro acts and stuff that are around. It's like, I mean, you hear like some Adele song or something and it's obviously the same hook from a, you know, from an Aretha song. You know, it's like chain, chain, chain. With a different lyric, you know, and, you know, or the same thing. What was that big Sam Smith hit? It was just a ripoff of a Tom Petty song. Won't you stay with me? 'Cause you're all I need. This ain't love, it's clear to see. But darling, stay. You know, I mean, all these big hits, you feel like, you know, sometimes you don't hear it at first. Sometimes you think it's original, but if you dig deep enough, sometimes you find those things. You know, at Daftone, there's a certain philosophy there that's kind of understood by everybody. And if you lick something, if you rip something off, if something's real derivative, like that is not cool. Like you don't get respect for that. You know what I mean? Songs have to be new. The licks have to be new. I mean, you can be inspired by stuff. Say, I want to do something kind of like this, or, you know, I want something to feel like that or something, but you got to make your own line. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You gotta do your own music. So, I mean, we're trying to do original music and we're writing songs and stuff. So it's really not that, it's really not like thinking that far outside of the box. It's just more of the style is, you know, consistent with the records that we dig, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, ripping off songs and stuff. One of the things that, you know, you've done, you know, by yourself and with the Dap Kings is like soundalikes for, you know, commercials and even for movies and things like that. What did you learn in the process of making soundalikes? I know you did Uptight, the Stevie Wonder tune for like Chase.
Yeah, we did a lot of those, but you know, one that was amazing is we did a lot of music. We did about six songs for American Gangster. Hank Shockley was doing the music, and he came into the studio and produced these sessions with us where we did all these songs, and he wanted them all to sound like the original. They were almost all replays.
also did a bunch of commercials and stuff where we did sound-alikes or samples and stuff. And yeah, it's amazing to do that stuff. You learn so much quickly just because you have to get inside those arrangements, you know, especially the Motown ones. It's once you try to just dissect them, you know, on studio monitors and think of it scientifically, it's definitely put together in a way you never would have thought of, you know?
Yeah.
Two drum sets and these weird ethereal piano lines and guitar lines, and just the way the arrangements work are not necessarily the way you imagine them, you know? You think of these Motown songs, you think you know them, how they work, but what's the bass line for My Girl? You think it's dum 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 dum, but the bass never plays that. It's the guitar, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just little things like that you don't realize until you try to take them apart. So it's amazing to get into those things, man. And, you know, both arrangement-wise and musician-wise, but also as an engineer trying to cop those sounds and stuff, it's like, it's very challenging and it's very humbling because, especially the Motown stuff, you just can't touch it, or the James Brown stuff, you just can't touch that stuff, man. The more, you know, by trying to emulate it, you just respect it that much more. You realize how you know, unbelievable those recordings are, you know, for any time.
Yeah.
So
I've definitely noticed a trend of more and more of that stuff happening in the culture generally over the past couple of years. Have you seen an uptick in the amount of times people call you for that kind of thing?
No, not really. I mean, I think that the peak of that stuff was probably, for us personally, I think it was a few years ago. We haven't been doing that kind of stuff that much lately. And I don't know whether that's because people aren't calling as much or just because we're more hesitant to do stuff like on spec or cheap or something at this point, you know? Because there's a lot of, you know, like when an ad company calls you, you know, they want you to do a lot of stuff on spec.
Right. They're calling five other people to do the same thing and they pick the best one or whatever.
It's not just that. I mean, you don't know. OK, well, hopefully the company that you know, Nike or whoever the company is, hopefully they only have one, you know, Wieden Kennedy or one ad firm. But they might have more than one. And at that, even if it's one ad firm, they may have a bunch of different ad men trying to put ads together. And for each of those ads, they may be going to five or six different music supervisors, and each of those music supervisors might be going to five or six different jingle houses. You know, it's the same way they make pop records now these days. It's like run the shit out and have this shotgun approach where they have a million people, you know, like the last Beyonce record or something had like 75 different writers and 50 producers or something on it. Those are the people that made it. There's probably another 500 writers and record producers that thought they were going to be on the record and didn't make it, you know, and they never got a penny. They just do everything on spec. It's just a real weird, it's a real weird model of business right now, you know?
Yeah.
So they come to you and they always tell you like, hey, we know exactly what we want. We want that Dap King sound. We want you to do it exactly like you do it. We want this song. They definitely going to use it. They're real excited about you doing it, you know? And, you know, if it works, we're going to give you $80,000 or something, $100,000. But, that, you know, I always say, well, what's the kill fee? What if you don't use it? What are you going to give us? Well, we don't really have a kill fee, or maybe we can give you $2,000 or something, you know? And I say, man, I'm not playing, you know, we don't work for spec. You know, we know what we're doing. We're pros. We're not like, you come to us, it's not a jingle house. It's not like a dude sitting with a MIDI controller in front of his computer, knocking something out for you in an afternoon. It's like a whole crew of people going to the studio and creating something very unique, you know? So I'll tell them like, hey, I don't need $80,000 or $100,000. Like we need like, you know, $30,000. You give us $30,000 in cash, we'll do it. I don't care if you use it, you know?
Yeah.
And they won't do it because they don't have the money and because they got a million people working on it. They can't do it, you know? So, I mean, part of it is that, you know, so we pass on a lot of that stuff. And now it's like, you know, with Tommy has his own studio, like the Dunham or the Diamond Mine and stuff. And a lot of times we'll pass stuff to him and, you know, he'll pick up that kind of stuff. But again, it's, I mean, he did a Heineken commercial for them last year. And he killed it, man. He killed it. The thing sounded great. And it was exactly what they asked for. And, you know, they didn't use it, of course, you know. So they did it for the kill fee or whatever. But at the end of the day, it's like, if you're going to get all your boys together and put a studio session together, it's like, it's really not good business to do it for that short bread. You know, it's like, if you're going to do that, make your own record, you know,
yeah.
Make another record.
Yeah.
Like that's really in the long run, that's what's going to take care of you. So,
yeah. And, you know, you obviously the breakout group on Daptone has been, you know, you're the band, you're kind of the MD of the Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. And so it seemed like, you know, looking back on your career, it seemed like a real breakthrough song for you guys was the title track of the 100 Days, 100 Nights album.
Whoa.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I'd say breakthrough, but yeah, that, as far as hits goes, that's probably the closest we've ever come, you know, which it's the most recognizable song we probably have.
Yeah, what do you think it was about that song that kind of made it stand out?
I don't know. I mean, I think we've recorded a lot of songs that are a lot better than that. Not that I don't like that song. It's a good song. I mean, there's probably something catchy about it because it uses numbers. Any song that has numbers in it, if you want to look at not what's great about music, but what sells in music, it's a whole different set of parameters. You know what I mean? I mean, remember that girl Feist had that song that was like, 1, 2, 3, 4.
1, 2, 3, 4.
It was like some terrible song, but she counted to four and everybody got so excited and smacked their hands together. Oh, she's counted to four. And everybody wanted that song. It was in every fucking Apple commercial and everything, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, I mean, if she wasn't counting to four, if she was singing about something else, nobody would have bought that song, you know?
Yeah.
It's a weird question. I mean, one of the things that we've been successful at is focusing on not focusing on that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is like trying to really pay attention to what feels good about music for us. So, you know, firstly, I don't think I have the experience or the mind to try to figure out why people buy shit, man. I can't for the life of me figure it out. I mean, if you turn on the Grammys or if you turn on the radio, you know, it doesn't make any sense to me. So I can't really, it's hard for me to weigh in on why one song works and another one doesn't. We do records all the time that I think are the greatest records ever, and I'm sure they're going to be hits. No cares, you know. I got a couple Grammys, not for records I thought were very good. You know what I mean? Like they were for records that I thought, you know, not that there wasn't good things about them, but man, they're definitely not in the top 10 or 20 or 30 best records I've ever made, you know? So it's really hard to look at any of that and kind of, I don't think you can simultaneously have an honest conversation about what sells and what's good in music, you know, two totally separate things. And one of those topics is very uninteresting to me.
And, you know, you mentioned the Grammys a second ago. One of them was obviously for Back to Black, the Amy Winehouse album. Yeah. Is it true you didn't really like the songs when you first heard the demos of them?
No, it's not. I wouldn't say that at all. I mean, what happened was I think Mark Ronson played me some stuff and he said, hey, do you want to help kind of produce this with me and arrange it? And hook up the arrangements and everything. And I said, can we get some publishing for that? Because, you know, there's not much here other than, I mean, they're beautiful songs, but they were basically, you know, the chords and the melodies and the lyrics were there. That was all Amy Winehouse. She wrote that stuff. But as far as the arrangements, there was nothing there really. You know, there was not much there. So I kind of asked him like, hey, are we going to be able to get publishing? And he's like, no, man, she's not giving up any publishing on this. So I said, man, I'm not interested in writing it if hooking up the arrangements or asking my band to do that, you know, if we're not going to get publishing. So anyway, of course, we went to the studio and we ended up hooking up the arrangements anyway, because that's what we had to do. We were hired to just record it. But what are you going to record? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, there's some real amazing lines, you know, what's that? You know, I'm no good. Mm-hmm. Like that was our horn section came up with that line, you know, but we don't get any publishing on that. Those guys made their $300 for the day or something. That's that, you know, it's gone.
Yeah.
So, I mean, again, it's kind of like one of those things where everybody looks at like this Amy Winehouse record is this huge, amazing thing for the deaf people in a lot of people's eyes. It made us, you know, within the industry, it kind of opens the door. Like we didn't make money off of the Amy Winehouse record, you know, and we didn't. It wasn't like we started selling a lot of records. It wasn't like there's a lot of people who got into that record and later went, oh man, who are the Daft Kings? I got to find out about these guys, you know?
Yeah. One thing I did want to ask you about is about your arranging. Take a song like Sharon's Make It Good to Me, for example.
I don't know, but it is tonight.
What your friends say, it's a shame.
Let them talk, I don't care if it's right. You see the eye.
Right? There's a lot going on there. You got the band, you got the horns, you got strings, you got a, you know, tambourine coming in at the end when it kind of goes to double time.
Mm-hmm. Said, come on, baby. I said, come on, darling. Tomorrow may not ever come.
nothing's too busy, nothing gets in the way of the vocal. Where did you learn that?
Because I think that the danger is, like, you get inside something, and whether it's, you know, how complicated and clever your arrangement is, or what you're able to, how fast you're able to play on the guitar, or, you know, what a clever lick you have, where there's those types of things that are very kind of ego driven and people have this very kind of intellectual ownership in. I think a lot of that, those types of things in music and in engineering too, is like, it's just about listening as objectively as you can. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I know you're, you know, running up against here, but one or two things real quick. So, you know, a lot of what we end up talking about on this show is hip hop. And, you know, you guys have obviously, projects you're involved with have been sampled a ton of times. Mm-hmm. Most famously on, you know, the Menahan Street Group was sampled on Rock Boys.
With all due respect, thanks to the duffel bag, the brown paper bag, the Nike shoe box for holding all this cash. Okay. Boys in blue who would grieve before the badge.
Okay. So the thing about hip-hop sampling is most of the stuff that is sort of in the canon of sampled songs comes from a very specific time, kind of between, like, you know, 69 and 73. Like, it's kind of that specific.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think it is about your tunes that kind of are playing that sort of role today?
And they sound good, I assume. I don't know. I feel like they we're making records that sound good and they feel good, and so people want to take it and people want to hear it.
Absolutely. That sounds fair. And, you know, so what else is coming up now for Daptone?
Oh man, some amazing stuff. The next album we're putting out is a Son and Star album, which is, you know, Sondra Williams and Star Duncan Lowe have been singing as the Dapettes behind Sharon, you know, in the Dap Kings for the last bunch of years, sang on the last record. And they've been touring with us for a while. And so we put a record out on them where it's just the two of them together, you know, as a duo. And it's an amazing record. It's called Look Closer. Out in May. We did a great video for it in my backyard with my phone. It's coming out in a couple weeks. But I think today or yesterday or something, they dropped the Look Closer. The initial track kind of came out on something. I don't know, some web exclusive something. I don't know what it is. But so that's coming out. We're going to do another volume of Daptone Gold.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to New York tomorrow to finish up a Christmas record or a holiday record with Sharon Jones and Dap Kings. And there's also a second Sharon Jones record that we're kind of in the middle of, which is like an orchestral suite, which is going to be some pretty high concept thing. It's going to be amazing. There's a Como Mamas record that we recorded with the Como Mamas, the three gospel singers from Como, Mississippi, that we've done a bunch of records out of Como. There's a record with them that we did, but with music. They came up to New York for the Apollo show.
Oh, wow. Because for people who don't know, their previous record, and I think what you were going to talk about, the compilation from their mm-hmm. whole area, their record was a cappella.
God is able.
God is able.
Just to carry.
Just to carry you through.
It makes no difference.
Yeah, it was a cappella. So we did a record with them. But Tommy did a record with them when they were in New York last time. Unfortunately, I was out of town, so I was very sad to miss it. But he did a great 45 Out of the Wilderness with them, with a band behind him. So we did a whole album of that in December. We put a band behind him at Daptone. They stayed up by Daptone for a few days, and we cut out this album, and it's nasty. It's unbelievable. So we have that album. There's possibly another Como record too. Also the Walker family, great singers from down there. They have a record that's done. We have the Live at the Apollo, which we did in December. We had the entire Soul Review up there at the Apollo Theater. We recorded it and and filmed it too. So we're hoping sometime next year to be able to put that out as a movie, you know, as a DVD and a live concert album, you know, like a double album or a triple album or something.
Wow. Maybe you're going away from this plan now, but in the past you've only done, you know, even as recently, I think as last year, you've only done 2 to 3 full lengths per year, when it sounds like, you know, with the amount of acts you have, you could easily do 2 or 3 times that number.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know whether we're going to go that far beyond that number. I mean, I think like just as it's a very small, you know, it's all hands on deck and we do everything ourselves. I mean, there's a lot of companies that say they're independent, but they have some distribution deal with Sony or Warner Brothers or some, you know, label management company, or they're under some other umbrella. We don't have any of that stuff. You know what I mean? So, you know, we hire independent publicists for our campaigns and stuff, but we pretty much do everything in-house. We're doing the artwork, we're doing the music, and we have our fingers on every detail, you know? So we really don't have the bandwidth to do a lot more records. And we talked about it years ago when the company was starting to be successful. You know, and I talked about it because it would have been very easy for us to start signing acts and just writing checks to people to go make their own records and putting out a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, we could be putting out 20 records, 30 records, 50 records a year if that's what our model was. But you know, we're very aware of why we're successful and who our fans are and why they're loyal. And I don't think we could do that many more records a year. So, I mean, we usually do 1 to 2 major records a year, and then another, you know, one or two or three smaller records, you know, reissues or compilations or, you know, something like the Como Mamas, which we know realistically we can't sell that many of, you know, something like that. You know, so we have all those different things going, but we're not going to try to get bigger. You know, we can try to get better.
And one final thing. Since you would be better equipped to answer this than pretty much anyone I can think of, and I'm on the phone with you right now, I know you're a big fan of the Meters, and you know they're a big influence on a lot of the Daptone acts and a lot of the stuff you did. And I've been fascinated for a long time by the Meters and by New Orleans in New Orleans music in general, and kind of the very specific feel and rhythm it has. And I was just curious what you thought made the Meters specifically and music from New Orleans in general unique.
Well, I mean, I think that's a confounding question that I've been battling with and having, you know, late drunk talks about at bars, heated arguments for years. I mean, there's a lot of things that go into that conversation. I mean, first you have a certain group of people in a certain place at a certain time, and that's you can never really understand or get inside of what they're doing or try to recreate that, you know. And you talk about the Meters. I mean, I think you have to, you know, you got guys like Alan Toussaint down there, and you have Cosimo Studio, and you have Marshall Seahorn, you know. And any record you see that Naomi Neville, I mean, that's Alan Toussaint, you know, by another name, you know, trying to pretend he's a Neville brother. But all those Lee Dorsey records, all the stuff that came out of there, even you look at you know, Fats Domino records or whatever coming out of there, they have a certain sound. And I think one part of it that's huge is that there's a different understanding of feel, of rhythm today than there was then. There wasn't, like right now, I think, and I don't know if this came out of drum machines or disco, or I mean, you could blame it on whatever you want, but right now there's a very finite idea of feel. Either something's straight or it swings. And if it swings, there's a certain percent of swing to it. You know, is it bop, 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 or is it bop, bop, bop? And if you listen to those records, you listen to a record like, even like, I mean, any kind of R&B record or something from the 50s or the early 60s, not just New Orleans, it's like kind of shuffling, and maybe the guitar player's kind of shuffling, you know, the singers are swinging, it's all different, and it works. And you listen to New Orleans records, you find it in a very extreme way. I mean, you find these piano players, you know, Alan Toussaint, but then, you know, before him, Professor Longhair, and, you know, this kind of stride kind of New Orleans piano stuff, and they're constantly shifting between swinging and not swinging, sometimes just in one hand at a time. Kind of an obtuse answer, but that, you know, that's the truth as far as I can find it, you know.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. I'll let you get ready for your trip to New York. Thanks a lot for your time.
All right, thanks guys.
First off, I want to give a special thanks to Donwell for taking the time to talk to me while he was in the middle of a tour. I also want to thank him for not using all of the embarrassing stuff Josh told him about me. I hope you enjoyed that section and got a little bit of an idea as to where I'm coming from. When talking to Meter Mates, the first of our two real guests this episode, one thing that really came through was the intricacy of their group dynamic. The amount of respect they have for each other, the way they're able to write together so quickly, and the way they play against each other on stage are really impressive. It was also really interesting to find out how Swell, as a new parent, balances his family and his rap career. And also, it was really funny when Sage came in looking for his pants. For more about Sage Francis, including why we brought him a gift of mustard that night, check out our talk with him on episode 81. As for Gabriel Roth, even though he is by no means a hip-hop artist, his insight into production and how he thinks about it is relevant to basically all of modern music. And let's face it, his work on Back to Black, the horns, the arrangements, make that record something really special. I was also glad to find out how Roth single-handedly revived Fela Kuti's Afrobeat sound, and how the whole thing started with a little bit of subterfuge. Special thanks to Yuval Tresser for hooking us up with Gabriel. Join us next week when we talk to rapper Big Pooh to celebrate the release of his new album, Words Paint Pictures. Pooh first became known as a member of the popular North Carolina rap trio Little Brother. But his solo work over the past decade reveals a more complete picture of who he really is. We discuss his whole career, from Little Brother all the way through the new album. You can find The Cypher on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at The Cypher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this episode, ideas you have for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. And if you enjoy the show, there are two key things you can do. Go to patreon.com/thecyphershow to become a patron and help us continue. Also, please rate, review, and subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can visit us online for playlists, our entire back catalog, and lots more at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
But the less information we gave, the more people made it up, you know?
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
And they sound good, I assume.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts. And playing with them, I ended up really falling in love with bass. We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Sit down.